So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Ryuwe.
Apparently, Yamaguchi-san did not get the job done. Val, exactly what happened last week when the lights went out?
Well, you know something. Thanks to a cold butcher's block and a little shrinkage, and of course, my good friend, John Wayne Bobbitt, who just happened to cut the lights just at the appropriate time. The big Valboski is standing at full attention, cocked, rocked, and ready to unload.
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock alongside Y.
That's me.
How are you?
Why?
Why not?
Why? Tell me why.
Isn't that how it actually is pronounced? Samoa Joe knows you on such a deep level that...
It's not just him. It's like a lot of people... I don't know. Like, how do you say Hoist Gracie? What's the proper way of saying Hoist? You know?
I've heard it's like, it should be Royce.
Yeah.
Like, it's the Gracies that have come up with the silent R gimmick.
There's no such name. There's no such thing as Hodger. Okay, you see R-O-G-E-R. No way is that Hodger.
Hyen.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. But, I don't know.
I want a Heginald. Like Reginald?
Heginald. Okay.
Or Henolds.
Yeah. Or, what about, okay, I don't know. This is stupid. But, for me, I think it's my own personal preference. I don't know what the proper way is.
Do you know what their favorite song is every December?
Who's? Oh, the Gracies?
Hudolf the Head-Nosed Reindeer. Oh boy, it's gonna be one of those fucking shows. What'd you think of my work off the top there? I spent a long time for shows like this, Mr. Ting.
No.
I've got to find the song that best suits it. And sometimes I'll put my iPod on and I just listen to songs. I'm like, what will fit? Mm-hmm. What will fit with a man's dick nearly being chopped off? And then Katy Perry's Part of Me just jumped out. And I was like, perfect.
So
because you could go for the obvious one.
Yeah.
Obvious ones are too easy. I was like, do I go for a joke that's just simply about a dick? No, that's kind of boring. Scar Tissue, kind of a dated song.
And no, this is way funnier.
Katy Perry's Part
really
of Me.
Really good. I love it because, I mean, she wrote that song after the fact. I mean, it's...
Clearly, she saw...
She was probably... Influenced.
Yamaguchi-san.
Yeah.
Dick Togo. Mm-hmm. And Teo.
Mm-hmm.
And was inspired. Katy Perry. Well, how are you?
Pretty good. Pretty all right, man.
Pretty all right.
Yeah, I'm doing okay. Yeah.
That's good. How's your aroma? You always mix it up. I'm very much a creature of habit when it comes to my... usual Tim Hortons that I have, but you go tea. Is that some kombucha tea or whatever? Oh, it is. It's that green.
It's a matcha latte.
Matcha latte.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's delicious. I mean, if I'm going to pay like $5 for a coffee.
Does it taste like tea? Is it flavored?
No, it tastes like a latte, but yeah. With like sort of a, you ever had like green tea ice cream?
Yes. I like green tea ice cream.
Just like that.
Oh, okay. But yeah. It's warm.
Yeah. It's delicious.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I like that aroma that they do. They'll serve those little chocolates when you get your coffee.
I toss those out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, are you in training shape right now? Are
no.
you?
No. I just, I don't. Chocolate's good, but like, I love chocolate when I don't sweeten the coffee. Like when you just like put cream in.
Uh-huh.
Chocolate's good. When you, like, chocolate though by itself with like a sugary thing, it's a little too sweet. I've been telling you, everybody knows by now about my Kit Kat, chunky addiction.
Of course. Everyone, blow by blow, available on a recent Review of Raw episode.
So, you know, a friend of mine works at Nestle and just, like, unloaded boxes of, like, Kit Kat, Chunky, and Rolo at our place. And
yes.
So I'm a little chocolated out at the moment.
Oh. I want to make an announcement before I forget. On the past couple of weeks, I've been going through and figuring out all the dead links for our Review Away shows, which our good friend Brad has done a fantastic job compiling for me to go through and fix. And I've pretty much corrected them all at this point, and the feedback has been great, because a lot of our listeners, I think, have no idea that all our archive, it's available for everyone. You can go back and listen to all our different shows.
Yeah, we should like maybe make an ad or something.
Yes, we should.
How do we get the word out? How do we tell people?
Well, these are up for free. The least the people can do is a little legwork on their end. But in going back and fixing these, I've discovered there are some lost episodes out there.
Uh-oh, what do you
ones, mean? Ones that I cannot find. I have...
Oh, they just don't exist, period?
Yes. So I am hoping and pleading that there is a diehard listener out there who may have some of these shows saved that can transfer them to me. And thus, we can share them with the rest of the world. There are 5 episodes we recorded in early 2012. For whatever reason, it's 5 consecutive... it's over the course of a couple-week period where these ones have missed. So, the first one is the March 8th, 2004 edition of Raw, which we recorded on March the 21st of 2012. Then we have our WrestleMania 20 review from March the 28th of 2012. Backlash 2003, April 18th. Capital Combat featuring RoboCop on May the 2nd. And ROH Showdown in the Sun Night 2 on May the 9th of 2012. Those are 5 shows I am looking for so that we can upload them and complete our archive. And if anyone else doesn't discover any dead links, please make me aware of them. I am currently now addressing our old Review of Raw episodes, which I have uploaded a ton of over the past week. Unfortunately, it's not just that we have some loose operation here, but Wei, you can attest to the fact that if there's one thing Fight Network loves, it's website redesigns. And sometimes in the crossover, shows get lost, and it has created some issues in the past, and thus some shows and links have been changed while we have crossed over websites, and thus shows from years ago, the address has been changed, and thus I need to re-upload some shows.
Yeah, it's quite the headache for you, mainly. I think
there was one a few years ago where we lost everything, and I had to re-upload everything, and it was quite the chore that took me pretty much 2 solid weeks of coming in on weekends on top of that to work on this. It was a massive
headache. Why don't
we just
put everything up on like BitTorrent or something?
I think many of our shows are up on BitTorrent. I am amazed that people actually do steal our shows to post elsewhere when we do offer them free of charge.
Yes.
Just out of the goodwill, but still people need to steal them. It's like, it would be like handing out, you know, free samples at the Metro of a brand new barbecue sauce and someone taking all of them and running away. It's like, you don't need to, they're complimentary.
Yeah.
You idiot.
I think people, you covet something more if you have to work to get it. You know, if you either pay for it with money or if you have to, like, even stealing. Stealing takes a bit of effort. Like, you're not supposed to get it. Oh, man. Oh, I'm doing something wrong. This is hot.
Did you ever steal anything as a kid? Were you ever a shoplifter?
Never. Never stole anything. Unlike you, I know you've stolen chocolate bars.
I did.
You had quite the mean streak. The only time I've ever stolen something was actually earlier this year.
Uh-oh.
This is my one and only shoplifting experience. I wanted to buy some almonds at Walmart.
The statute of limitations is not up yet, so you tell this story at your own discretion.
Whatever. Who cares? So it was at the Dufferin Mall, and then the Walmart there. And I wanted to buy almonds. And these almonds are expensive, man. Almonds it's like...
Sounds like you're
it's like worth more.
Your conscience is quite the enabler.
Yeah. So anyway, I tried to buy almonds. And then, like, you know, Walmart, they have, like, the scoop bags that you can buy in bulk, and you weigh them. So, like, well, we're doing some shopping, so I scoop it. I get my little bag of almonds. And then we're doing some other shopping with my roommate and I. And then by the time, like, you know, I had to go grab a cart. So I was like, hey, can you hold on to these while I grab the cart? And so my roommate holds on to the almonds. And while he's just, like, walking around, he's not just going to, like, hold these almonds. So he puts it in his pocket. And then, like, I get the cart, we grab our things, and then we leave. And then we end up, like, on our way to the register. I'm like, hey, do you have those almonds? And then he's like, oh, yeah, where are they? Oh, they're in my pocket. And then we just looked at each other.
Oh, boy. You had a crossroads moment of decency, and you chose the path of easy resistance.
Well, my roommate really was the enabler. He's like, hey, let's just walk out with these.
Oh, my God.
Because there's no, like, barcode or anything on them. There's no tag. You just, like, write down the little thing.
You're so a criminal.
Like, yeah. I'm a badass, man.
Fuck. Wow. You stole
So we stole almonds. But the thing is, like, I'm somebody who, like, really believes in karma. So we walk out with the almonds. We stole like, a $5 bag of almonds. Then we had,
and your,
like,
roommate got run over by a car, didn't he?
No, that didn't happen. But because I am a believer of karma, we had somebody help us carry this large item into our car. I ended up tipping the guy, like, I don't know, like, $5.
That's
so
nice.
So he basically got our almond money.
I don't know if that made you sleep at night.
No, I'm still haunted by this.
Still my favorite. So I think I've shared this story before, but still my all-time favorite story of someone tipping somebody. It was my good friend Brad Peck, who was our guest reviewer for the WrestleMania 20 episode back on March the 28th of 2012, one of the lost episodes. Leaving a future shop after selling a bunch of DVDs. I guess you could sell them back to future shop, whatever. So he had some money, and he came out, and there's a guy with a Tim Hortons cup sitting on near the future shop, and he tossed a toonie into the guy's cup and then heard a splash. And the guy looks up and said, "You think I'm homeless?" And it was just the most awkward exchange, as my friend, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." He thought the guy was homeless and was giving him $2 out of the goodness of his heart, and the man was homeless. He was not homeless, and now his coffee was ruined by a dirty coin being thrown into his coffee. I would have been livid myself.
So don't do anything nice, is the rule.
One final story before we get into our double-packed review of Raw from 1998. I had one of the most bizarre phone call incidents I can ever recall this past Sunday. I have a lot of pro wrestlers, fighters, numbers in my phone. And for wrestlers, I typically put their gimmick name into the phone.
Yeah.
Just because it's easier to, whatever, to scroll.
Yeah.
It'd be a very bizarre if someone stole my phone of looking at these names I have.
Monty Sop. You're not going to type that in.
So, on Sunday, I get a FaceTime call from a particular wrestler. And I know it's got to be... First of all, I'm like, this has to be a butt dial or something. But it's coming from a wrestler that has passed away. And passed away years ago.
Oh, my God.
And I just never deleted the number from my phone. So I just ignored it. And I thought, maybe did I accidentally dial it? Because the phone was in my pocket. Maybe I just dialed it wrong myself. So later in the day, I get a normal call from this same number. And it's really creeping me out a bit. Wow. It would be even creepier if I let you know what the gimmick name was, but I'm not going to. So I answer it because I'm just as curious as all.
I think I know who you're talking about.
So I pick up the phone. I'm like, hello? Hello, I'm calling for Dave. I'm like, you've definitely got the wrong number. He's like, oh, I'm calling for Dave so-and-so. I'm like, yeah, sorry, man, not me. And I hang up and then promptly deleted this number from my phone. And I'm wondering, like, did this person, like, when they passed on, and their cell phone was probably disconnected. Mm-hmm. Did someone get this new number and somehow mistakenly call me? Like, what? I don't think that's possible. Do you have any idea how this could have happened?
I have no... I mean, I don't know. I don't know how that would be possible.
Like, I was trying to think in my head, like, maybe I accidentally butt-dialed this number earlier in the day.
No.
And this person was calling me back when they saw they had a missed call from my number. But this person...
looking for somebody?
Was looking for a specific person with a name.
Why would they FaceTime you?
I have no idea.
You should call them back.
Well, I've deleted the number now, so I can't do that.
Man. Is it in your history?
I don't know.
It's got to be.
Well.
Well, let's call them. Call them now.
No, we're not doing this. It's too weird. But what a bizarre...
I need to know who this is. I need to know how they got that person's number. This is a mystery. This is a Scooby-Doo mystery.
It's a very mysterious set of circumstances.
Yeah.
And I didn't have an answer for it, so...
Strange.
That was why...
The pro wrestling ghost stories that I think only John Pollock...
It is. My phone might be haunted. Well, are you ready for Raw? A double billing.
I'm creeped out now. I'm scared. I don't want to talk about wrestling. I don't want to get FaceTimed by dead wrestlers.
And to be honest, I remember very little from this Raw because I watched this show like a full, like 6-7 days ago. I got this out of the way so early in the week because I knew I had a lot coming up. But boy, it felt great to go into the weekend and not know I have an extra show to watch on top of everything else. You not so much. You kept up with your waiting schedule.
Yeah, I mean, I watched this like in like 4 different parts.
So, oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, anyway.
I found these shows pretty easy to watch, but boy, is there extremes when it comes to reactions of certain time periods. Like, typically, you know, people look at WWE today and it's like, oh, it's so bad. And you look at 98 Raws and everything is kind of colored as, oh, it's so great. And I've said this many times. It's like there's a lot of middle ground that can be seen. The WWE of the present, really not all that bad. And wrestling or WWE of 1998, not all spectacular.
Not at all. But I think what it was, though, was fresh.
Absolutely. It was fresh stars. Yeah. New stars that had not been on top. Everything felt new about the WWF in 1998. It was a new era.
And fresh and a more, I guess, adult-oriented tone, which is novel at the time.
Very, very different approach if you had been a longtime wrestling fan seeing the WWF in this incarnation. Mm-hmm. And at the time, thinking that, man, how is this the same company that was promoting their style of pro wrestling in the 80s? Yeah. And you look today where they've pretty much made the full transition right back to a PG product. But if there's one thing that's taken for granted today, it's the level of quality in the ring, which in 1998, it was pretty poor, like consistently. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had your talent on this show, but it was star power that people were reacting to more than anything.
But you know what? Like in some of the stars, you know, you look at people like Triple H or, you know, whatever, Austin, Rock. I mean, they've been known to have great matches, but not necessarily on these shows. On these shows, it just seemed like the wrestling itself was a real afterthought.
These shows were not formatted to be, you know, in-ring, you know, satisfying that need, which I don't think is a faulty premise with the idea that you're going to get your – if you're an in-ring fan, you can pay your ticket to go to a live event. You can buy the pay-per-view. That's where you will get that. And the television is largely all the building up of these stars and promoting you to pay your money to see it.
But then it almost just seemed like in this show, these people were just getting in the ring to be able to call the show a wrestling show. You know what I mean? They're just punching and kicking each other for about 2 minutes without any real story being built up in the ring just so that they can call the show a pro wrestling product.
That was one of Vince Russo's many famous quotes. Was his goal was, when he was still writing for Raw, to have a whole show of Raw without one match. That said, that was a goal he had.
I mean, I don't know if you could do a 2-hour show of just, you know, acting and sketches and character things like that, but I don't think that's I do think it's a terrible idea. But I don't think you... I think you can maybe try half... Actually, TNA did do that. They tried the whatever reaction, didn't they?
Right, right. I think that was more like shoulder programming to the show, but you're right. It was, you know, the show that followed Impact, that was more like almost a post-show to what Impact was.
You're almost kind of talking about like what the UFC kind of has, you know, with basically just using countdown shows to build up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good comparison point.
Or Tuesday Night Titans.
Tuesday Night Titans, which maybe one day we will revisit another episode of. But these shows, they aired on August the 3rd and August 10th of 1998, so they were well on their way to SummerSlam that year, which was the Steve Austin Undertaker main event, which was built up all summer long.
Which we have reviewed,
that you can go check out in our archive, SummerSlam 98. It is there.
What a trip it would be to listen to this and then listen to that.
Right? Yes, where we are reviewing them in reverse. I remember that SummerSlam. I think we reviewed it on the road at a UFC.
It was, I looked it up. It was like actually in 2013.
So we reviewed in 2013.
It was like to hear us 2 years ago talk about something that happened in the future.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
It's some weird shit, man.
Yeah. No.
So
I wasn't a thief back then.
No, Wei was an upstanding citizen during SummerSlam 98. But you were on your own highway to hell.
Yes.
These were taped on this first episode. We're going to be reviewing both shows. The first one was taped on July the 28th. And that night, look at these numbers. Raw did a 4.9 on the USA Network. Monday Nitro did a 4.2. Those numbers are crazy.
Yeah.
Granted, USA was in less homes. So, I mean, that rating is the total viewers is it's not what a 4.9 would mean today, but you know, very strong cable numbers, especially in 1998. Your announcers are Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. And the show starts with The Nation coming out. The Rock, Owen Hart, D'Lo Brown, and Mark Henry. And The Rock and Owen had just won a opportunity to challenge for the tag titles the previous night on the debut episode of Sunday Night Heat.
Yeah, the very first.
Yes, which was... just launched as kind of a lead-up to SummerSlam. Like, it was designed to promote SummerSlam, and thus that's where the name Heat came from, and ended up lasting for years and years and was a really strong program on the USA Network. There were weeks that show was doing 4.0s and above. It was a really big show for the company.
It was the B-show.
It was the B-show, but it was an important show. It set up a lot of angles for Monday. The stars were on Sunday Night Heat.
It was definitely more important than SmackDown is today.
It's 100% was more important, and it was very much complementary programming to Raw at a time when the WWF's popularity was through the roof at that point. So The Nation is out.
You know what else was popular at the time? Like almost side by side next to the WWE?
What?
South Park.
South Park was huge in 1998.
There were a bunch of South Park signs.
Oh, it was sweeping the nation in 1998. I remember that. It was... what? How old? 14 years old we would have been in 1998?
They used to air like South Park...
it was like Fridays at midnight.
Yeah, on Global.
I used to stay up every Friday night and watch South Park.
Yeah. I had some friends who whose parents wouldn't allow them to watch South Park.
Wow.
And we were like 13, we were 12, but like they started watching it and then like Kenny died and then they're like, oh, no, you're turning this off.
Remember when they did the big reveal about Cartman's mom?
Yeah.
And then they went on hiatus forever?
Yeah, they had the Terrence and Phillip episode.
Yeah, I like Terrence and Phillip.
Yeah. The thing, I mean, at the time, you know, the first episode, the first season of South Park, first couple of seasons were really primarily about shock and, you know, the same thing as the Attitude Era. But that show evolved into something much more political.
South Park really matured and grew into, like, a social commentary. And the immediacy of South Park, where they will start an episode and then it airs within the week. Yeah, it's an incredible turnaround.
There's actually a documentary, like a little mini.
I know, I haven't watched it yet.
It's really good. Anyway, but talking about pro wrestling, you know, the Attitude Era, we look back and like, oh, yeah, he said cocksucker. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. Wow, this is so cool. But then you kind of wish, you know, that it pro wrestling went through the same maturity process as, you know, or is at least just, you know, maybe you kind of hope that it grew into a bit more of a sophisticated product, which I don't think we have seen yet.
We're still waiting on that. Maybe Billy Corgan will be answering that call from people. But this was 1998 when myself and Wei Ting were just two 14-year-old jackoffs. Rock wants the tag title match right now. Commissioner Sergeant Slaughter comes out, and they threaten Slaughter. This is followed by Steve Austin coming out alongside The Undertaker, who those two are the tag champions at this time. Two main eventers with the tag titles in 1998. Austin charges the ring, and he gets double-teamed as The Undertaker is following him to the ring, but then gets distracted by Kane at the entrance and bails on Austin. Mankind runs out to attack The Undertaker. Austin would stun Owen. Rock stomps him in the corner, and then Rock avoids a stunner. Austin clears them out with a chair, and Ross promises that the tag match will happen tonight. Tonight will not be a bait-and-switch night, which was a frequent tactic in the Monday Night Wars, especially on the Nitro side of promoting something big all show long and then getting very little payoff at the end. So Jim Ross staking a claim that if you tune in tonight, you're going to get this tag title match. But the summer-long storyline had been if The Undertaker and Kane were working together and if Austin could actually trust The Undertaker during their build-up to SummerSlam. And it turned out to be a really effective build and would be, from a pure pay-per-view buys perspective, the most successful SummerSlam in history.
Mm, wow. I mean, the segment, immediately you notice just how incredibly hot these crowds were at this time. And the product was hot, and the stars, as a result, were all incredibly... They seemed like megastars, and you had megastars here. You had Taker, and you had Austin, you had Foley, all in one segment. The segment was very brief. They just basically came out, brawled, and just kind of made its point and concluded very quickly.
Yeah, and I've said it before, but I think also, you know, Austin had caught fire. Rock, you were certainly seeing that by the summer of 98, and it would really escalate as the year went on. But you had all these fresh stars in the eyes of the audience, and I think it really helped the fact that the last, you know, the two big stars prior to this were Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And having them gone, mm-hmm. it emphasized the fact that this was a new era. You didn't have these guys in the shadow of the last kind of regime of stars. And I think there's a real argument to that, much like when they were trying to get over Bret and Shawn, Hogan wasn't around. Mm-hmm. And when Hogan was first gaining fame and when Bruno Sammartino left, I think there's really something to that of... You know, a lot of new stars are trying to create right now. You do have Cena. You do have Orton. You have, you know, from the past 10 years, those stars are still all over television.
Yeah. I think it helps, though, that these top stars are so different. Yeah, like, different in many ways to Bret and Shawn and what that whole era represented.
Yeah, everything about the WWF, it was new, it was fresh, and it was different.
Mm-hmm. Visually, too, the show looked... I mean, compare this to a show like what we reviewed last week in King of the Ring 1993. Visually, it looks completely different.
And that's a span of 5 years mm-hmm. Versus 1998 to 2015. The look of Raw, certain adjustments have been made.
Not that different.
And it's... You know, you just look at how the presentation evolved in 5 years in the 90s.
They put a red light on the crowd and then that LED screen on the front.
Now there's a hashtag on the screen.
Yeah.
So we've moved on. Our first matchup, and I instantly just put my head down. I was like, oh, Christ, I picked this. The Brawl for All, which was in full effect in August of 1998. How many of these? Did you watch these?
Of course I did.
Okay, I did too.
See, like when we did it, we of course reviewed the Brawl for All in our fifth anniversary show. But we did it. We didn't really review it. We just kind of did a live commentary.
Yes,
and we watched it. So.
I can honestly say, watching these, I might as well have been watching these for the first time week because I didn't remember any of this from watching them last year with you.
Me too. And I'll probably forget this.
I probably will too. Where's the Brawl for All DVD? Of all the ideas they come up with for DVD releases, I'm surprised a Brawl for All one hasn't been put out.
Or at least a behind-the-scenes network special.
Yeah, like just the key people involved, why this bloody thing happened.
Yeah.
Bring back Bart Gunn and his jean shorts. So we have The Godfather against Scorpio. And this was right as The Godfather was transitioning from comma into the pimp. Mm-hmm. And the hoes were starting to accompany him to the ring, and he was kind of being distanced from the Nation as he was evolving with this character. The Godfather had lost the decision to Dan Severn, but Severn, in a just completely awkward backstage interview, if you want to call that, just says he has nothing to prove, and if he has a score to settle, he will do it without his hands being bound. Basically shitting on these tournament rules and delivering in his monotone way, he was withdrawing from the tournament.
But what was the legit excuse?
I think he just didn't want to participate. And
yeah.
He was out.
This is really stupid, and I'm not really getting paid to have these.
This sucks. But, yeah. I got paid a lot of money to do this kind of shit outside of the WWF.
Yeah.
The Godfather offers the hose to Scorpio, and he turns them down. And Scorpio had defeated 8-Ball in the opening round. Fights that I would just love to go back and watch.
Oh, the classic Scorpio 8-Ball.
Yeah, the Scorpio 8-Ball classic. I'm sure many of these guys... Never mind. Well, they turn the arena lights down to give it the real boxing feel. To me, just added a dead atmosphere for a wrestling environment, turning the lights off like this.
These were incredibly awkward, and I even remember at the time, especially when I was young, having never really watched any boxing. Now, at least, I'm a bit more knowledgeable about what an actual boxing match should look like. But I think coming in as just a pro wrestling fan, to all of a sudden to go from kind of the energy and the pace and the excitement and the movements of a pro wrestling match to something that's very confined and very technical and subtle, like a legit boxing match, I don't think much of the audience was conditioned to be able to appreciate it.
No, and when you went back to, 70s and 80s territory wrestling and their TV that they would produce, often they wouldn't light the crowd, but that to me is something where a throwback isn't always, brought back for nostalgic purposes. Today's crowds, to me, you don't light the crowd, it's a negative to me. I think that that's something you want to enhance. You want to promote the fact that look at all these people are here. That's something that goes for MMA as well. I think that adds to the atmosphere. So the rounds here, we have 3 1-minute rounds. You get 10 points for a knockdown, 5 for a takedown, and then an additional 5 points for the most punches landed. These are the same rules as Metamoris, correct?
I don't know about the punches landed part.
No. The Godfather lands a handful of lefts and wins the first round. Lawler says that Scorpio has limited amounts of brain damage after he turned down the women, a man who was clearly ahead of his time when it came to CTE awareness. Danny Hodge was at ringside overlooking the match. There was a right body shot by the Godfather in round 2, tying him up in the corner. Ross lists off the injuries that Dr. Death Steve Williams suffered after his knockout at the hands of Bart Gunn. A knee injury, a jaw injury, and a torn hamstring. So that was just 3 of the many, many, many injuries that were the legacy of the Brawl for All. And Steve Blackman hurt his knee, Ross notes, and he also might be out of this tournament, and he would not be the only one out of this due to injuries.
And I think it'd be one thing if these guys... if you took a guy like Steve Blackman and said, you know what, you're not going to be involved in any storylines for the next foreseeable future. Just focus all your training time and recovery time on this. But no, these guys had to wrestle matches at SummerSlam. They had to partake in storylines. They had to keep everything going on while training and having these fights. It's a whole lot of risk for not very much reward.
Yeah, I think you also were playing to an audience that it's not as though mixed martial arts was going through some big boom period. In fact, in 1998, the UFC was at its lowest point of their existence.
It wasn't even a thing.
It wasn't. It wasn't a thing at all, which is why it was always funny a few years ago when MMA was on fire on pay-per-view and people were talking about, well, of course, it's real. Wrestling's not. People are going to gravitate towards that. And it was just funny because you clearly were asleep throughout 97, 98, and 99, where wrestling was murdering the UFC on pay-per-view. So it continued with Godfather blocking a takedown. He was given 5 points for that. The crowd just hated this. And then Godfather blocked a takedown at the end of the fight. Godfather is announced as the winner, and he will take on Bart Gunn in the semifinals. But there were instances on Brawl for Alls we'll review further in the show that the crowd did get into, particularly if they just got sloppy and out of control, but this was not one of them. It felt like this was an audience that they paid to come see a pro wrestling show and had no interest in this.
Yeah, I think if they were just basically slugfests and brawls, those are always a bit more fan-friendly, but the fact that they added the takedowns, when you have uneducated fans about
this and primarily uneducated fighters. I mean, these are professional wrestlers that, outside of Mark Marrow, not too many of them had limited boxing experience at most for the majority of the guys that were hired for this.
I think what this stuff, it's always captivating to me, though. Like, I watched this and I was like kind of gripped throughout the whole thing just because what a car wreck spectacle all these things were. I just can't believe this thing took place, you know? It's just so bizarre. And it's only in pro wrestling where you can have a guy about to have a real boxing match against a colleague and a friend come out playing a pimp with three hired women hired to look like prostitutes. They have to come out, play a little skit where the fighter asks if his friend wants to leave with these prostitutes. And then you have to get in the mindset to punch your friend in the face, like for real. It's so bizarre.
Bellator wants to be different. That should be the path they're going down, where guys come out as characters, they do their promo, they do a little skit, and then we go into the fight.
Yeah. It's just crazy. Cause like, I don't know how much preparation all these guys, you know, took, but like, I've seen like MMA fighters in the back and, you have to get like really psyched to like go out there and punch somebody in the face. This was just like, I can't imagine the type of mental gymnastics they had to do to be able to remember their lines, to be able to, you know, think about technique, if any. I mean, probably not much, but.
Can you just imagine this today?
No.
With some of the guys on the roster?
It's insane, dude. No, I think a lot, these days people, by and large, are a lot more knowledgeable about, you know, what a real fight looks like, what they're supposed to do, how to maybe defend takedowns or maybe try a rear naked choke or something. But
these wouldn't even be sanctioned today. I mean, you wouldn't even be able to do these. Like, this was in California. This wasn't in, you know, some podunk city.
It's just like the fact that there's no headgear, the weight, the size differences were just outrageous. And some of these.
Carl Ouellette with one eye.
It's so crazy.
It's this was in 1998. It's like this was not something out of the 60s where it was just the Wild West. It was like this was in our lifetime this happened. Michael Cole, a very young Michael Cole, is with the New Age Outlaws in the back. They'll be taking on Kane and Mankind tonight, who cost them their tag titles. Road Dogg even referred to them as belts on a WWF broadcast, a no-no in today's world, and then says the D stands for determined and the X stands for excellence in the lamest DX reference maybe in broadcast history.
Determined excellence.
And then follows it by saying, or you can suck it. That Billy Gunn adds. Oh, I'm sorry. Monty Sopp.
Yeah.
The Outlaws come out. Road Dogg does his usual opening. And then we have Kane and Mankind against the Outlaws.
They showed an exterior shot of the arena, and they had a giant inflatable Steve Austin.
Yeah.
Like, that's basically the height of the arena. This thing looked so scary.
They used to have these whenever they'd run house shows or something, they have the big inflatable figures.
Taker
outside
one, but this Austin one. I mean, they all just look creepy because they. I mean, just imagine like a giant inflatable version of a human being. Like, I wonder where they keep these.
Probably in a warehouse somewhere.
Probably the like where they keep the SmackDown fist.
Yes. Kane and Mankind against the Outlaws. The Outlaws attacked Mankind on the floor during Kane's pyro as it went off. Kane and Mankind get the advantage on Road Dogg. He tries to fight out of the corner, but he's thrown down by Kane, tags in Billy Gunn, and Kane blocks a double-team vertical suplex, and he suplexes the Outlaws, and Jerry Lawler says he has never seen that before. A vertical suplex delivered to two men at the same time, just breaking new ground in 1998. Mankind clotheslines and sends Road Dogg to the floor. He then gets a chair and cracks Road Dogg in the head, which is responded by Billy Gunn, nailing Mankind in the head with a chair shot. Welcome to 1998. Road Dogg hits a back suplex to Mankind in the ring, clotheslines him to the floor, and then the Outlaws get their poetic justice and double vertical suplex Kane as the referee is distracted. Gunn and Mankind are on the floor as Kane tombstones Road Dogg and pins him at 5 minutes, 19 seconds as Ross brings up the point that the Road Dogg, who was just pinned, was not the legal man. But then when he realized that was probably not supposed to be uttered, he just ignored and moved on.
Yeah, it wasn't supposed to be uttered, and I don't think people cared anyway.
Jim Ross, like, too much attention to detail. Oh, he wasn't the legal man.
Jim Ross is really interesting to watch on this show, especially compared to last week when we heard one of his first WWE performances in the King of the Ring in 1993, where that style was much more like his 80s NWA style, calling very straightforward matches. Here, you know, in 5 years, you could kind of see his evolution, or at least, you know, a change in style. Being a lot more, I guess, much more of a showman, a lot more concerned about kind of talking about storylines, setting up, you know, the tone of a certain scene versus calling specific moves.
Yeah, he had also gone through a bout of Bell's palsy by this point. He had been let go a few times by the WWE during that time period between 93 and 98. But at this point, he was the vice president of talent relations, so he held quite a lot of power by this point in 1998.
How about some of these chair shots?
Jesus Christ.
Just like...
And really... Completely gratuitous?
Completely. Especially in the case of Mankind, who would just... this wasn't even it for him in terms of unprotected chair shots on this show.
This summer, that summer of 1998, from the King of the Ring onwards, I'm sure is a several-month period that Mick Foley would look back on and probably cringe at what he did to his body over the course of those 2 months, because he was so wrecked after that King of the Ring, where he said he was never really the same physically after that match. And... throughout the summer, it was a lot of this stuff of just you watch that dumpster match at SummerSlam. It's 5 minutes of him being murdered by the Outlaws.
It's just like it was his thing, you know. I'm the guy who takes chair shots to the head.
Yeah, it was not a great trend that he set. Then we had highlights from Raw the prior week, where Road Warrior Hawk was stumbling to the ring and then fell off the top rope. And he's been going through his demons.
Man, I completely didn't see any of this stuff when it originally happened.
Well,
I had always heard about it, but to actually see it...
Someone felt that Michael Hegstrand, who did have certain issues, thought, maybe we could bring this to television. This is really gripping. So we have Hawk and Animal in the locker room to react to what happened last week, and Hawk announces that he is Michael Hegstrand.
I'd like to take this time to address... the World Wrestling Federation fans, as myself, Michael Hegstrand, because that's who I really am, not as Hawk at this moment, and apologize for my behavior on last Monday Night Raw. I'd like to apologize to Titan Sports, Vince McMahon, everybody in the WWF, all the fans, and especially my partner, and I hope that you'll be understanding and maybe find it in your heart to forgive. And now I'm going to go out and do the Hawk thing.
And he apologizes for his behavior. He apologizes to Titan Sports, Vince McMahon, and his fans. And he hopes they can forgive him. And now I'm going to go out and do the Hawk thing.
Yeah.
The Hawk thing. Mm-hmm. All right. This was this would be a hallmark of 1998 and beyond, where when you gave your real name, that's when you knew... there was no bullshit here. This is the real guy.
Yeah.
I play a guy named Hawk. I was never a big fan of this angle. I thought it was pretty much in bad taste at the time. And then WCW would also do this later in the year with Scott Hall being drunk on television. So class at its finest in 1998.
I do think there's something cool about bringing a level of reality and authenticity to a show. And, bringing real life issues to pro wrestling. But, knowing that this stuff really happened to this guy and that he might have not been 100% with doing this, exposing himself like this on TV and being forced to do it, it makes it all kind of uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, it'd be like Elizabeth Berkley really having an issue with caffeine pills that were served over the counter. And actually had to deal with a 22-minute addiction in her own life that she was able to correct within one episode. Jeff Jarrett and Tennessee Lee call Road Warrior Hawk an embarrassment, and it's time for him to get scared straight tonight. So Jarrett and Hawk had a match. Jarrett attacks him from behind. Hawk hits a military press and then clotheslines him to the floor. Jarrett is ignoring the advice of Tennessee Lee. Hawk then clotheslines him off the turnbuckle. He runs shoulder first into the post, and then Hawk is sent into the steps. Ross is noting how both men have suffered a lot of losses. They need victories. There's a DDT to Hawk. Jarrett wants the belt buckle from Tennessee Lee, who struggles to take off his belt buckle, and this allows Hawk to come back and hit a neckbreaker, pinning Jarrett at 2.5 minutes as they are pushing dissension between Jarrett and Tennessee Lee. And then Animal comes out without his face paint to indicate the severity of this issue. This is a real moment. And hugs Hawk before they're attacked by Southern Justice, the former Godwins. And they're attacking the Legion of Doom as Darren Drozdov makes the save, attacking Jarrett. And this would be the progression of Darren Drozdov inserting himself into the Legion of Doom. And this would culminate with the infamous Titantron fall by Road Warrior Hawk later that fall.
Yes. Yeah, you know, again, a match that really doesn't even deserve real analysis. It's just all kind of setting up whatever storyline this was.
One of the best things about these episodes that have been uploaded onto the WWE Network is that a lot of the ads have also, that the WWE have had involvement with, have been left in there, including quite the partnership they had in the summer of 1998 with Stridex pads for those with pimple issues.
Why don't those get? Why don't they do advertising for that stuff anymore? I never see pimples.
I think acne has been cured.
It's been eradicated.
Because Stridex, back in 1998, featured Pitchman Triple H. And why was Triple H, of all people, selected? Because the tagline for these Stridex pads were, "Triple clean your skin," with Hunter yelling, "So you can deal with tougher things."
Oh my God.
Can't be letting zits get in the way of your real challenges out there. Stridex pads. I love these. These were awesome. They were also the title sponsor for SummerSlam.
Wow.
Vince McMahon comes out with Briscoe, Patterson, and Slaughter plugging the highway to hell, and that it intersects at SummerSlam with Austin and The Undertaker. And tonight, there will be a roadblock. This man just loved analogies, and says that you will see history made tonight when they lose their tag titles, and plays out the conspiracy theory that Austin and Taker are at odds with one another, and The Undertaker abandoning Austin earlier tonight in the show opening brawl. The Undertaker comes out with his Attitude Era music, mm-hmm. a nice kind of
a remix
of his old song. And then Austin comes out, cuts a quick promo, and walks out. And Taker gets annoyed at this, saying, "I'm talking to you, boy," and tells Austin that he's doing what Vince wants him to do and driving a wedge between them. He doesn't want them to be champions and wants him to come and take his tag title, as Undertaker has been walking around with these tag titles. Austin returns, takes his title, and then exits. Taker says that before SummerSlam, Austin is going to be the safest SOB in the WWF. And Ross just adds the fact that Austin is not happy about that because he doesn't need a guardian angel, which was something that is subtle but very much lost when a performer will say kind of just a throwaway line that Ross added context to. The fact that Undertaker is saying that he's going to protect Austin. Austin does not want this kind of a protection. It's just a nice little added line that was very subtle, and it just conveyed the message that maybe the line on its own, the viewer at home wouldn't have really put two and two together. I like that aspect. And then Rock and Owen are in the back. Rock cuts a promo about being asked a dumb question about the problems between Austin and Taker. You could certainly see with Rock, certainly not the polished promo he would become, but was certainly just coming up with lots of different ideas and very much evolving that character and getting comfortable with his promos, I thought, at this time.
He definitely had the confidence and the swagger, you know, maybe not... Not the peak of his abilities, but I mean, totally. I feel like, despite him being the IC champion, which today is almost a detriment for you being on the main card, here he was, you know, IC champion, but still insulting the main eventers as if he was right up there. So I thought he was still very good here.
Then we had a Stridex Triple Action Replay featuring X-Pac hitting a spinning heel kick to Rock. And to emphasize the triple clean action, they just showed three consecutive shots of X-Pac hitting the spinning heel kick.
Yeah, from three angles.
It was great. So Triple H and X-Pac were scheduled to have a singles match, with the winner getting the IC title match at SummerSlam that year. They came out together with China. Insert joke here. They went back and forth. Hunter hit a flying knee for a two count. X-Pac hit him with chops and kicks and then missed with a flying seated senton into the corner. Ross says that SummerSlam has never been bigger and may never be bigger again, which turned out to be an accurate prediction from Jim Ross. It's rare you hear someone on a wrestling show saying, this year's WrestleMania, it may never be this big again. Anyway, China then trips X-Pac from the floor as he's going for the Bronco Buster and then drives a forearm at him. Hunter's looking confused, but hits X-Pac with the pedigree and pins his good buddy at 5 minutes, and X-Pac is pissed afterwards. They get into each other's face, and they were teasing problems here with DX, which, what a payoff we would get for this teased dissension.
This was all a lead-up to that.
This was all
big moment
setting up a grandiose reveal.
That is very appropriately put. You know, anytime I see Sean Waltman on one of these shows, I'm like, oh, God, another X-Pac match. But then I'm always pleasantly surprised because he always delivers in the ring.
Dude, he was always, I think, underappreciated during this time. He was always a great worker. And in 1998, on that roster, he was a giant addition to that talent pool. But the character got very stale in 1999 and beyond. Yep. But in 1998, I thought he was a great addition, a great pickup. His return that night after WrestleMania was a key point that year in Raw and shifting that momentum, and was involved with DX. It was a big year.
He fit very well within that group, and that group just, I mean, all, whatever, five of them just had seemed to just have great, at least visual chemistry and in terms of promos, too.
Val Venus, who will have a big role on this week's review, they showed him with Yamaguchi-san's wife. And then we saw a video of the two in a shower, and comes out and says he has the lightning bolt to charge for your goal, in reference to the San Diego Chargers. A bit of a fumble here when it came to a promo. And then we had Val Venus and Taka Michinoku taking on Funaki and Dick Togo. Taka Michinoku, the WWF light heavyweight champion at the time. And what a run that division was having in 1998 with Taka. We showed highlights of Yamaguchi-san the prior week slicing salami with a sword, which was the actual drop of the infamous choppy choppy your pee-pee line.
Right.
And this, as ridiculous as this storyline was, and we will get into it, this was like a several week-long storyline, the likes of which we don't ever see on Raw. Like, this was like a 4 week angle that they went through.
Well, deserved it. I mean, big celebrity involvement, you know? Yeah.
It had all the elements. So, Yamaguchi-san is with his wife and Teo in the corner. Ross plugs the house shows from the prior weekend in Toronto and Montreal and gives a shout out to TSN,
who probably didn't show this.
Yeah, thanks. Great programming we have just acquired. Yeah. Val Venus misses a splash in the ring to Togo, and then there's a double team suplex with Funaki. Venus clotheslines both, to which I believe it was Lawler saying that he just he took them both out of their sandals with that clothesline. Of course. Taka gets tagged in and immediately attacks Val Venus. They hit him with a DDT, and all of them stomp Venus. Yamaguchi-san is celebrating. His wife is looking very upset.
No, she's not. This model that they hired to play Mrs. Yamaguchi might have been the worst actress I have ever seen in pro wrestling.
Hey, her and Brooke Hogan. I mean, ability to put your hand over your mouth. Uncanny.
Brooke is Meryl Streep compared to this woman, man. This, like, she had to act distraught as Val Venus was getting beaten up, and I mean, it was almost like she was trying not to laugh. She looked so, like it was so bad.
So then, you know, wrestling at its base groundwork, it's theater, and it's conveying connections through minimal use at times of words. Sometimes it's very much through the actions. So how are we going to be able to establish this unlikely connection between Taka and Yamaguchi-san's wife? So we had Taka state about 5 times as he pointed to this woman, "My sister! My sister!"
Why did Taka do this?
My sister! My sister!
What did he just say? My sister!
My sister!
Is Mrs. Yamaguchi Taka Michinoku's sister?
My sister!
My sister! My sister!
Oh, God.
So all these months, Taka Michinoku had a sister. What a small world. Married to Yamaguchi-san's wife. And now Taka would join Kai and Tai. And what a run they would have.
I don't know what to say about this stuff, man. How did Kai and Tai even get involved? They're in ECW.
They were in ECW, and then they were brought in earlier in this year.
Just
as a group, kind of enhanced their junior heavyweight division.
Right. Okay.
I mean, they were, talented guys. Dude. I mean, like Dick Togo.
Yeah.
Great performer.
If you've seen any of like their whatever 8-man tags, not just in ECW but back in Michinoku Pro, those are some of my favorite matches ever. And it's just unfortunate that the name Kai and Tai is going to be remembered for shit like this in North America.
There was a great moment where they all did the Val Venus pose as he was down after taking his spike DDT.
Dude.
They were very funny.
They're hilarious, especially like when you watch them like play heels in Japan. This, I mean, they're just like kind of goofy comedy, tiny Asian guys, which nobody took seriously.
They drag Val Venus to the back for episodic programming at its height. This was a great tease for what would happen next. Where are they dragging him to? And nobody during that night's episode could have possibly predicted where this was going. We had another ad for the Stomp 2 figures with underwater action figures. What the fuck were these guys on?
these are the ugliest. I mean, somebody bought this for me as a kid.
First of all, what action figures can't go underwater? Is that something that you're prohibited from using a regular action figure with? Will they suffocate?
Let's just say I wouldn't have stole these from the Walmart.
Oh, wow.
These are just some of the shittiest looking toys I've ever seen. They showed an Owen Hart that...
Dude, it's Steve Austin with a scuba mask on.
But I mean, just the molds of the faces themselves. Like, look at the Owen Hart in this. It just looked like... You know, generic white guy. This guy didn't even have Owen Hart's hair. And for some reason, some marketing team decided within the WWE that, we've already sold the Headbanger Mosh figure. How do we improve on the Headbanger Mosh figure? Let's give him scuba gear and give him a water gun.
Ugh. These are terrible.
It's just so stupid. Like, what, But I'm kind of guilty of like buying into this stuff, though. As a kid, like I bought Ninja Turtles toys. Bought a lot of them, and then I made my parents buy them.
Well, turtles go underwater.
Okay, but like the turtles, at some point, you know, they can't just keep releasing Raphael in his regular form. So they made like Raphael the skateboarder, or Raphael I actually had a water cannon Raphael, just because it was like the latest thing, the newest version.
It's like all the different monopolies they would come up with to just customize them to...
Just to sell you a new toy. But man, it's brutal just to see it as an adult and to see that this shit was even made. Headbanger Mosh in SWAT team gear. You know?
Val Venus is dragged to the back past all of these photographers. No one coming to the aid of this man. Then we have D'Lo. He says he's being forced to defend the European title even though most San Diego fans aren't card-carrying American citizens, and he is wrestling this match under protest. as Dan Severn comes out. And Severn had applied a submission hold on D'Lo 2 months ago, ripping his pectoral muscles, which led to the chest protector for D'Lo Brown. Mark Henry comes down immediately during this match. Brown has the advantage, hits a leg drop, gets a two count. Then Steve Blackman, who was very busy at this particular time in the WWF, he comes down. He's a mutual friend to Dan Severn and Ken Shamrock. It's all D'Lo Brown until Severn gets a double leg takedown and a belly-to-belly suplex. Ken Shamrock comes down as Severn is throwing Brown around. Shamrock then sends Henry and D'Lo into the steps, gets on top with strikes, and the DQ is called at the 240 mark. Ken Shamrock looked insane during the summer of 1998.
Does he deserve a nomination?
I think he runs away with our particular award.
Congratulations.
D'Lo then runs up the ramp, and he gets attacked from behind by Edge, who is simply identified by Jim Ross as the man fueled by rage from some sort of source.
Hmm.
A lot going on in this 2 minute and 40 second match.
Yeah. Edge here. It's,
back when he was, he did not speak.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a bit of a, I don't know, it's just a bit of a jump to see Edge in this manner, where they're almost trying to portray him as like a mini Undertaker, like, you know, or a Sting, or somebody who just like comes out and doesn't speak, because it ended up being so different from what he eventually became, you know, so... I don't know if they even knew what they were really doing with him.
It made me think watching Edge, especially in 1998, where he came in, and if you weren't really aware of him off the independent scene, I mean, here comes in this guy, very much a pretty boy, being given this push, but it wasn't immediate, and he really didn't hit his stride until a few years later when the tag team took off. But you just think, man, place Edge in today's environment. It's like he would have been treated very similar, I feel, to Roman Reigns, where there would have been such a big backlash, I feel, against him, where people would have just held certain things, I feel, against him. And instead of being just...
But Edge was never put in the main event of WrestleMania.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He was brought along much slower, but when he was signed, I mean, he was expected at the time to be given a big push, and there was talk of this guy he would eventually... make his way to the top. They were very high on him when he was signed in 97, 98. Kai and Tai is in the back stomping down Val Venus. They have chairs all around. And then we cut to Tiger Ali Singh, who enters the ring, doing the updated Ted DiBiase gimmick with his sidekick, Babu. And they show highlights from Sunday Night Heat, where he paid a woman to eat dog food. Says that women have no class, morals, or respect. And he says he is going to pay a woman $500 for every article of clothing she strips off, prompting Babu to choose a heavy-set woman to come from the crowd, which elicits boos from the audience when they see the shape that this woman has. She starts taking her clothes off, and then Tiger stops her and says he will pay her $500 for each piece of clothing she puts back on. And this got cheers from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
If you thought that objectification was subtle in 1998, this would not even be the lowest point of what we would see over the course of these two episodes of Raw.
Oh, yeah. No, not at all.
Like, this was downright offensive.
It was offensive, sure. I thought it was hilarious.
I thought he was
very good. Let me just say
he was a very good talker.
I thought he was very funny. The Pride of Milton, Ontario, Tiger Ali Singh. Did you notice that this woman? He asked the woman for her name. She gives it, and then he says, "It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what your name is."
Oh, I did not catch that.
Yeah, he came up with this before The Rock. The Rock stole this from him. Stole this from Milton, Ontario.
Wow. Well, there you go. Straight out of Milton. Val Venus is then dragged into a room and placed onto a chopping block. And the door is shut. And we've been left with the idea, is this man going to be beheaded on television? I mean, I think that's a logical conclusion you could make from this. And
He was tied up. Oh, okay, yeah.
Like, they were placing him on a chopping block, And Jim Ross just ends the segment by saying, you don't think he would, I don't know what. Finish that sentence if you are creative. And then we just go back to the show as this man may or may not be murdered in the upcoming segment. And they plug everyone to go to WWF.com after the show for Code Red, the original Raw post show, including an exclusive interview with the heavy woman from the last segment with Tiger Ali Singh. What a score by that producer. Code Red. And then we had the main event. Steve Austin and The Undertaker taking on The Rock and Owen Hart for the tag titles. Ross says this is the biggest tag match of The Rock and Owen Hart's careers going for the titles. All four would fight at the start. Austin and Taker were in control. Owen would clip the knee as The Undertaker goes to chokeslam The Rock. Ross notes that Owen and Ken Shamrock are going to have a Lion's Den match, even though both were on separate courses during this show in separate feuds. Austin is stomping down on Owen in the corner, fires up. Owen goes for the sharpshooter. He applies it, but then Rock breaks it up. And then, Austin went for the sharpshooter and Rock broke it up. Ross very much pushing SummerSlam very hard. Austin blocks a Rock bottom, then into a double clothesline. Taker comes in, chokeslams Owen Hart. Rock makes the save. Austin and Rock are fighting by the announce desk as The Undertaker tombstones Owen and pins him at 11 minutes, 13 seconds. And then in the aftermath, Mankind ran in, applied a mandible claw to The Undertaker, but then Kane comes in with a chair, and The Undertaker, with his back towards Kane, ducks, and Kane takes out Mankind with yet another chair shot to the head for poor Mick Foley, as Ross asks who Kane was aiming for. And then Taker grabs the chair, stare downs Kane, and what does The Undertaker do? Chair shots Mankind! This poor fucking guy on this goddamn show takes another chair shot.
He's the,
He took more chair shots than segments he was in.
He's the, basically the rack for the chairs.
God damn, he was playing the role of Kenny in 1998. The Outlaws run in, Gunn goes after Kane, and Road Dogg mistakenly goes for The Undertaker before realizing that he's not supposed to be attacking The Undertaker. He freezes and then just goes to the other corner to attack Kane. And then the show finishes off with the door opening. And I don't know what happened over the last 12 minutes that we had been watching a match, but I guess they had just been sitting there talking to Val Venus. And his ass is censored. And the show cuts off as the lights go out and we hear the sound of a chopping going down. What was chopped, we don't know. And that's how the show ended. Now, what's amazing about all this is that this show on the network featured a segment being edited off that was not the tease of a man's dick being cut off, but rather a segment involving Sable introducing the Oddities and a match between Golga and Mark Mero. They decided, we've got to cut that out of this show.
Oh, wow.
So I guess time constraints on the network.
Yeah.
So that was our first episode of Raw. What an episode. I mean,
wow.
Wait, how could you wait another 7 days knowing that Val Venus might be dead? Or at the very least...
I don't think you could die from that.
Probably
still live.
Maybe losing his member. I mean, what a cliffhanger.
A possible castration.
Or a something hanger.
Yeah, so...
What did you think of this episode?
Well, very big on name value, very big on atmosphere. Very big on storylines. A lot of storyline on this show. Can't say I was all too thrilled with any of the wrestling, honestly, or any of the angles. I mean...
What did you find an easier show to watch? This week's 3-hour Raw or this 2-hour Raw from 1998? Was there one you... Do you have a preference? Because they're very different shows in presentation.
To watch one 2-hour Raw versus a 3-hour Raw?
Yes.
Probably the 2-hour Raw. Because it's less time. And... I mean, because of the star power, too.
Like, I cannot remember the last time Raw went off the air that I was thinking, man, I can't wait to see the follow-up on SmackDown or next week's Raw. Mm-hmm. And I think in 1998, they did a very good job of promoting, you know, with the exception of Heat, it was week to week. A Raw would end, and you would typically be left wanting to tune in the next week.
I think if anything, I'd probably be more... I can't say this show was a better show, or was even that good of a show. You know, the product was hot, but was the show good? I really don't think it was. But I think what made it enjoyable to watch was the fact that it, you know, watching wrestling at that time was more of a communal experience. You'd watch it, and then you'd call your friend afterwards on the phone and be like, hey, did you watch this? Did you watch this? Did you watch this? And the next day at school, you'd be talking about, did you watch that? Did you watch that? Did you watch that with everybody at school? These days, I don't really have those conversations. I mean, I talk.
Was that the case for you in like, you know, in 1998?
Yeah. Even like on Mondays before Monday Night Raw, people would be talking about what was going to happen.
Because I had the identical experience where I thought I was like the only one that watched wrestling throughout the years prior to this. And then 1998 hit, and everyone was suddenly aware of wrestling, at least all my guy friends were.
Yeah.
And it became, you know, we would get together, we would watch Raw. They were always asking about stuff. We would get together for pay-per-views.
Yeah, and, you know, what would get people talking tomorrow? It's not necessarily, oh, man, this match was that great. No, it was, did you see Val Venus possibly get his dick chopped off? You know, did you see the new Headbanger Masha SWAT team action figure? I mean, okay, maybe not that one, but it's just like shock TV.
Yes, bro, I got a zit this morning. You know what that means. Triple the action.
But, like, I think much of these shows were crafted to create that, you know, we didn't have water coolers in my school, but like, you know, the locker talk, you know what I mean?
By the way, I've never seen anyone talk around a water cooler in my life. And we have one here. I've never seen anyone standing by our water cooler talking.
People would be quiet.
Why don't they, like, microwave chatter? Isn't that more likely? You heat up your lunch and you're waiting around and that's going to spark conversation? I mean, a water cooler, you're in and out. You're filling up your glass and you're out. It's a 20-second adventure. A microwave, much more of a longer experience depending on what you got. You got stir, the soup, maybe. That's 2 minutes you're looking at. God forbid something out of the freezer and defrost is brought into the equation.
Okay, microwave talk.
Yeah,
that's what we'll
podcast it. Chatter. That's the new thing.
Yeah, right. So,
like,
I mean,
never talk to me outside of this.
No, never.
We get all we
no
need out
to.
Of this.
We have no reason to. But wrestling, I think, was easier to watch back then because it was more of a, you know, more of a friend activity, social activity.
Well, also when you have something that is really popular. There's also the thing that you don't want to be left out when, you know, everyone's going to be talking about this. I feel with Mayweather-Pacquiao, that was a big thing, too, was that if you follow sports radio, if you know that coming out of this weekend, this is the event everyone's going to be talking about, and I want to be part of it. I want to have my opinions. I want to chat about it with other people. I want to be part of this event, and I think Monday Night Wrestling had that for people a lot of the time, where the next day if you went to school, if you went to work, and you knew your friends would be talking about this, you wanted to be a part of this. And when you were watching the show, another thing about this 1998 Raw, this crowd felt like these were stars. They loved the show. You wanted to be at these shows. Mm-hmm. And that ECW conveyed that a lot of the time. WCW did for a while, where, you know, you could say this crowd's having a lot of fun. I think people see that with NXT now. And it feels like an important deal when you see a crowd reacting like that to these stars.
Yeah, big time.
So the following week was a taped edition of Raw. It was Monday night, August the 10th of 1998 from Omaha, Nebraska. And that particular night saw a much closer ratings battle as Raw did a 4.5, Nitro did a 4.6. So the summer of 1998 was really the last really competitive period between the two. I mean, WCW would still be doing strong numbers going into 1999, but WWF had certainly distanced themselves coming out of that summer in 1998. But it was certainly a very competitive field mid-1998. The show starts off with Mankind with his favorite object, a chair that he is throwing around backstage, yelling to himself that he can handle the truth before the open to the show. And then they show a video of Mankind calling out The Undertaker the prior night on Sunday Night Heat. And Kane would come out attacking Mankind, beating the shit out of him, and then taking his mask off and revealing it to be The Undertaker. With the question, how did The Undertaker get Kane's outfit? They must be working together.
I looked it up after this and, like, Undertaker's done this
multiple times. He's unmasked as Kane.
He loves to dress up.
Yeah. And it always gets a big reaction as if he's never done it before. This time, I don't even know how many times he had done it prior to this. But
he was a big DDP La Parca fan. When, remember when DDP did that and he was dressed up as La Parca?
Mm. Anyway, so, but you can always notice that they always have the full sleeves, not the one exposed sleeve. Like,
oh, that's right. The show opens with Pyro. As Mankind comes out, he says he's tired of being lied to, says there is only one person who always tells him the truth, and asks Mr. McMahon to come out. Vince McMahon comes out looking confused. There's an Austin chant. Mankind is sitting on the mat, and McMahon calls it humiliating and loathes people that need his help. He says he's going to hurt him with the truth. He says it was not an accident that Kane hit him with the chair last week on Raw, and then The Undertaker chose to annihilate Mankind and not Kane. He says they are in collusion and are one and the same. And then Vince jumps as Kane's music goes off, and out comes Kane with Paul Bearer. And Bearer says, for once, you are going to have to listen to the Fat Man. He says he won't let Vince get into their heads. He asks how he would feel if someone tried to poison the mind of his son, referencing Shane McMahon. Says that he has made a lot of money in his 7 years with the WWF, but doesn't need Vince McMahon anymore. Vince says that Kane is not the son of Paul Bearer, because that's a son of a bitch.
Hmm.
What a clever line from Vince McMahon. And says he can smell the stench of death on this man's breath, and he believes it's The Undertaker that he is staring at. And he goes to unmask him when the lights go out, and for a long period of time, it's dark, the lights come on, and The Undertaker is in the ring, and he has Vince by the throat. Mankind goes to fight him, and then Kane has disappeared during all of this. Vince runs to the back, and then Mankind hugs Paul Bearer to end the segment, and we are left wondering who is aligned with who. Like a soap opera.
There was a lot of soap opera stuff here, and I kind of felt lost without any of the context. It seemed a little complicated if you're just tuning in midway.
Jim Ross notes the, quote, internet rumors that DX is disbanding tonight as they preview the show. Taker walks into a dressing room where we see Kane inside. Then Sable comes out to a very big reaction, and she introduces Luna and the Oddities with a horrible dubbed-over version of the ICP theme music they used to have. This featured all these wacky sound effects, including a phone ringing. This was terrible dubbed-over music. Luna and Jacqueline had a match. This was Jacqueline's WWF debut. They showed last week with Luna attacking Jackie with roses, this being something we did not see. And Ross compares Jacqueline to Monica she compares this feud, rather, to Monica Lewinsky and Hillary Clinton, to put us in the time frame of 1998. Sable yanks Mark Merrow off the apron, and then Kurgan chases off Merrow. Luna sidesteps, and Jackie takes referee Mike Chioda to the floor. Jackie then throws Luna by her hair, knees her low, and then Jackie climbs to the top. Sable shakes the rope. She falls down, and Luna hits a swinging neckbreaker and a splash that almost misses, and Luna pins Jackie at 224. And then Sable passes Luna her bikini contest trophy that Jackie had previously stolen from Sable. So now Luna got to hold the trophy that she did nothing to win but was going to be acknowledged as the bikini contest trophy winner.
Mm-hmm.
Are you with me? This sounds like a lot.
Yep, I'm with you.
They would pack a lot of story into these segments. The New Age Outlaws arrive in a limo. They're looking very upset, as were we for the next announcement that the Brawl for All was continuing. Darren Drozdoff against Savio Vega. And they show highlights of Droz breaking Hawk's nose in the opening round. Add that to the injury department. And Vega defeating Brockus. Jack Doan is the referee, so on top of it, we also had untrained pro wrestling officials officiating shoot fights. Though Jack Doan was actually pretty fierce in a upcoming fight in terms of getting into the faces of two contestants.
I think I'd take him over the Mark Hunt and
John Sharp.
Yeah.
They should have had Jack Doan in there. There was a takedown by Vega, but got no points. It was called a slip. Then Draws nearly knocked him down. Again, it's ruled a slip. Ross notes their limited boxing skill, which was something Ross did not have to provide for us. I think we were able to connect the dots. There were wild throws by both. Draws gets a takedown, got a pop for that. Very educated crowd, I guess, in Omaha. Vega then applies an underhook but cannot complete the takedown. Draws gets a trip takedown for 5 points. Draws lands a combination, and the fight ends. It was exciting as my recap, and Draws is declared the winner.
Your recap was very exciting.
A lot of this was a lay, pray, and stood up again.
Just a lot of really wild swinging. That's what it was.
That was it. Fine analysis. Hunter and China show up in the most un-DX-like vehicle you could picture them in, this baby blue BMW that looked too nice that it wasn't going to be destroyed later in the show, but it wouldn't. Michael Cole is then with China after the break, who are just hanging out by this car, and Cole asks a question. China tells him to suck it and shoves him into the car. This was so lame.
This poor man, I mean, you see Michael Cole today and, you know, he seems, especially not so much now, but like during the time when he played heel and even some of the moments where like he, you know, where there were divas on commentary and he'd like really question. Anyway, he just kind of came across as a guy who with a lot of confidence, a guy who also, you know.
Probably built up a lot of angst.
Exactly. Seems like he was really bullied back when he was a kid. And it wasn't so much when he was a kid, but it was like early on in his career when in scenes like this where they just treated him like shit. You know, and this is how.
Wouldn't be the last time tonight.
No, not at all. This whole episode, he was just treated as a total dork. And, I mean, you almost got the sense that they were building some type of, like, like, this is how, like, you know, Steve Buscemi's character in Billy Madison gets made.
It's like they would mention the fact that, you know, Michael Cole used to work at CNN, and then you'd watch him during this time period, and you just think, like, what an idiot. Like, why would you leave such a credible job for this and this treatment? LOD 2000. Remember, they were rebranded in 1998. They come out. The pyro goes off, and this forces Hawk to stumble off the ramp. Uh-oh. They come back from break, and the officials are concerned with Hawk as he's trying to defend himself, but he's slurring his words like he had just been pulled over by the WWF Ride Division. They showed an angle on Sunday Night Heat where Southern Justice and Jeff Jarrett attacked Tennessee Lee, writing him out. That'd be all for the former Colonel Rob Parker. Southern Justice are out. Hawk attacks them. All four are fighting on the floor, and then Hawk gets helped to the back, leaving Animal by his lonesome as Southern Justice attack Animal when Draws runs in, fresh off the brawl for all, to even it up and clear the ring. And then Jarrett comes down with a guitar and smashes it over the head of Draws, and they proceed to cut Draws' hair with a razor as they were starting to build up Jarrett for the hair match with X-Pac at SummerSlam. I believe this was the introduction of Jarrett smashing the guitar over guys' heads. And certainly this was kind of a revamp of the Jarrett character into more of a badass heel, and aligning him with Southern Justice, getting him away from kind of the goofball Tennessee Lee manager, and kind of changing around Jeff Jarrett's character. This was the start of it.
Yeah, you could tell, you know, during this phase, a lot of people got their Attitude Era makeovers. And I think for some people, it worked out tremendously. People like The Rock, you know, even people like The Undertaker. Not so much, I would say, for Southern Justice, who, you know, were the former Godwins and basically just became these generic bodyguard types.
Not to say they were really lighting the world on fire as the pig farmers.
They were not, no.
Hog and pig.
But I'd say they're probably doing better than they were here. Southern Justice. Poor Draws. I mean, the guy has a brawl for all fight, comes back out to do this, and gets a guitar shot to the head. What would have happened if he got knocked out in the previous segment?
I don't know if concussion awareness was at its zenith point in 1998. Booking.
Oh, you can walk? Okay, go out and do the angle.
What if the opening segment with Vince and Mankind and Undertaker, what if that had ran long and they had to condense a segment? So they said, okay, Draws, you're going to get knocked out at the end of the brawl for all by Jarrett hitting you with a guitar shot behind Jack Doan's back during the shoot segment. and work the angle into the Brawl for All finish.
I don't know if you could.
Or would that compromise the integrity that Brawl for All had provided at this point?
There were no screwy finishes in the Brawl for All.
So to see kind of the caste system of D-Generation X in 1998, let's recap. The Outlaws arrived in a limo, Hunter and China in a BMW, followed by X-Pac arriving by foot with his duffel bag over his shoulder.
He probably parked his bike somewhere.
The hitchhiker of the group. Just hope that he wasn't doing the suck it sign at the side of the road. It could certainly give the wrong impression. The New Age Outlaws come out, and Tony Chimmel, I guess this was the first hour where certain words were banned, introduced him as Bad Billy Gunn.
Bad Billy Gunn.
Bad Billy Gunn. Followed by X-Pac.
Was that an actual rule?
I don't know, but he called him Bad Billy Gunn. I guess ass was a certain word that just couldn't come out. Then Triple H and China come out. Gunn, Road Dogg, and Hunter come out with... Billy Gunn and Hunter were wearing these just 1998 make me vomit glasses. Like with the yellow neon shades. God, did this scream late 90s. Lawler compares the Beatles to DX with China playing the role of Yoko Ono. What an analogy. Hunter says it's been a tough few weeks. X-Pac then so eloquently says he's had just about enough of you and your bitch, and calls both of them jack-offs. Hunter then says the biggest jack-off in the world is standing in front of him. Then he calls the Outlaws jack-offs. And then they would proceed to set the world record for the number of jack-off references we could possibly have in a segment.
The biggest jack-off in the world is standing right in front of me. And as far as jack-offs go, while we're at it, you two have got to be a couple of the biggest jack-offs I've ever met in my life.
Jeez, they're splitting up, no doubt about it.
Ho, 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 ho. Let me get this straight. You are calling me a jack-off?
Yeah. Yeah, he called you a jack-off, but more importantly, you're calling me a jack-off? We're jack-offs? Yeah, let's get this straight. You're a jack-off. He's a jack-off. You're a jack-off. Supposedly, she's a jack-off. And I'm a jack-off.
This word never even
We're
had,
all in agreement.
I think,
Everybody in this ring
a
is a bunch of jack-offs,
of
right?
To it in 1998 vocabulary. I don't think jack-off was ever a daring word, nor a...
Was jack-off the limit, you think, that they could have went? Like, could they not have...
Well, apparently they couldn't say jackass during this hour, because that would be saying the word ass. So I guess jack-off... was a much more wholesome.
Yeah, do you think they had a meeting in the back about what word they were going to use for this?
How about I call you a dick licker? I don't know. Anyway, they're all calling each other jack-offs to the point that we get to the boiling point where they ask if they should just split. And the crowd boos the notion that DX is done. And the greatest yell from the crowd, it's quiet as one fan just yells, "Stay together!" And it's time to give people the DX split as the four male members put their asses towards the hard camera and go to remove their pants when China stops them and says if anyone is going to give the split, it's going to be her. And China proceeds to moon the crowd by displaying her thong. And the guys are all stunned, A, that she speaks, and B, that she would reveal her ass. And Jim Ross says, they got us, and that DX is still together. And then Hunter proceeds to moon the crowd, and then tries to get a woman in the crowd to flash him.
Unsuccessfully.
What a payoff? After X-Pac was cost the IC title opportunity at SummerSlam... It was all water under the bridge because of China's ass. Which would be something that would tie Hunter and X-Pac together.
You know.
I would shit on this segment if this happened today.
Yes, of course.
Sometimes you watch things with rose-colored glasses, and this is the perfect idea of something where people look back and say, well, it worked in 98. No, there were still shitty segments, and this was among them.
Yeah, but it did work. This got you...
What does it mean that it works?
It means that there are kids and people gathered around the microwave the next day talking about this.
You see China's ass, bro?
Definitely.
No, I mean, live in Canada. We saw some crowd signs.
I don't think this stuff ages well at all, but I think if you try to transport yourself back into the context of the time, this was... The swerve is quite lame, yes. The punchline is very lame, but it was a fun segment, you know? People really reacted to this stuff. Back then...
This was totally a TV segment to keep people glued with the tease that DX was going to split up, and you wanted to see if this was actually going to happen.
Yeah.
And
but
they didn't.
They didn't know. But I think like people got really excited whenever they teased taking their pants off, which sounds completely ridiculous. But I mean, you had a whole arena full of men, full of dudes getting really excited. Oh my god, I'm going to see Triple H's ass! I can't wait to see this. I mean, that. All that aside, you can't disagree that this group didn't have great chemistry, and they hit on like a really, you know, fun, rebellious, young and hip tone that you know, I think was very well done at the time.
Michael Cole, not done his work for the night, was with Steve Austin in the locker room, and he asks him his thoughts on the evening. Pressing questions. So Austin, in our back-to-back segments of homoerotic activity, dragged Michael Cole into the shower and proceeded to spray Michael Cole with water. Like,
this is how serial killers are born.
Michael Cole comes back the next week and just shoots up the arena. That was it. We never got Austin's thoughts on the evening.
He didn't even know.
What are your thoughts? Go fuck yourself.
This is your baby face.
The Godfather's out next.
This is the same company who promotes anti-bullying. And
be a star.
They have their top wrestler.
Be a star or be a piece of shit, either or. The Godfather's out. Bart Gunn shows up wearing a classic outfit. Like 80s hair, Raw is War t-shirt, jean shorts. Oh, fuck.
This would make the worst Halloween costume. Like, who are you?
This was like Braden Walker if he had been in shape when he debuted. Yeah.
Who are you dressed as? I'm Bart Gunn from Raw 1998.
Yeah, I'm going to knock your brains out. Actually, that would have worked for this guy with the left hand. Bart Gunn approaches Jim Ross, who you're supposed to know is the head of talent relations during this quasi-shoot segment that we're going to try and convey to you, and says he's sick of hearing the excuses that Jim Ross has been making about Dr. Death losing to him, and he cuts this promo, and then, in a just absolute humiliating response, Jim Ross stands up and cuts a promo that I would say was 100 times better than Bart Gunn, the performer's promo, and Bart just kept yelling, and then he went and sat in the corner for the rest of the match. Jim Ross had a great promo here. It's like, Christ, if this guy could go, this would be a much more interesting match than Bart Gunn and Butterbean at WrestleMania the next year.
I was very confused. Was Bart Gunn here positioned as a heel? Like a whiny heel?
I think the idea was that everyone was, you know, those that were following this closely, you know, this was a tournament that it wasn't much of a secret, that it was designed that Dr. Death was the guy that was going to come in here, run the table, and win this tournament, and he was going to be a hot heel coming out of this tournament, and most positioned Dr. Death as, you know, they knew the relationship with Jim Ross, and I think playing off of this, that Dr. Death was Jim Ross's guy, and we're going to play off of that with Bart Gunn, I think that's really asking a lot of your fans to be aware of that level of the business, that they're watching it on a much more periphery level.
See, because I feel like you had, even though you didn't have Dr. Death win, the guy that you wanted to win, you had Bart Gunn here with the upset, telling an underdog story, an unlikely underdog story, and the way they treated him in here, it was, you know, he was almost complaining and very much a heel instead of somebody I think you could have had some mileage out of as this underdog.
Well, that's the one, that, out of the brawl for all, you didn't get the expected outcome, but you still got this guy that was just dying prior to the Brawl for All as Bart Gunn of the new Midnight Express, as Bombastic Bart, whatever the fuck his name was. And here he just, this guy is knocking motherfuckers out.
Yeah.
It's like, we can't come up with anything for this guy coming out of this?
Mm-hmm.
No, feed him the Butterbean the next year at WrestleMania. Like, you know, you could have at least gotten some positive out of a tournament that was largely a negative with, hey, here's a legit badass we've got on our roster, and we could do something with it. They did nothing with him.
Well, he can't be badass Bart Gunn.
That's true. That's true. Batter Bart Gunn.
Batter Bart Gunn.
So the Godfather is out for his Brawl for All with Vader.
No, it's not a Brawl for
All. Oh, sorry. This is just a regular match?
Yeah.
And he offers... this was a great Brawl for All match. He offers the hose to Vader, including one lady who had to have set the record for the least amount of clothing on a WWF broadcast up until this time. Like, she came out and might as well had a separate key accompanied by her ass.
It wasn't a Sable... Didn't she have the pasties on an episode of Raw?
I guess, was that a pay-per-view?
I don't know.
Well, this woman was certainly in the hunt for that distinction. She came out. I'm sorry, but it was a little weird that this woman, like, she was wearing this, like, swim outfit where there was, like, her ass is just hanging there. Like, it was just like there was fruit growing from it. And there's, like, children sitting in the front row here. It was just weird, man.
I'll tell you what's weird is the thought of Vader having sex. I've never...
With the mask.
Yeah, like, does he leave the mask on? Like, does
Who the man? Know? Or he'd wear the Darth Vader headgear.
Oh, Lord. I just never... I mean, you know, here I am presented with the idea that, oh, Vader is about to leave and he's going to have sex tonight. That's what they're presenting me.
Oh, he offers the hose to Vader and... Godfather then asks him if he knows what a hoe is. And as Lawler's looking at the three hoes, Lawler just says, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And Vader turns down the offer at first, but then Godfather ups the ante by offering all three. And Vader says, yeah, you know what? That's worth it. So he goes to take the women, but before he leaves, he walks up to Bart Gunn and says, if you get the same offer from the Godfather, you should take the women. And Bart knocks out Vader with a left hand and then takes down the Godfather, setting up their Brawl for All fight next Monday. And the women do end up leaving with the Godfather. And Vader, the big loser, I guess,
yeah.
Didn't get the winner's share of the purse money for the match and didn't get any of the hoes. Was not Vader time on August the 10th. Then another limo arrives. The limo budget was out of control in 1998, and out comes Val Venus and John Wayne Bobbitt.
Did you not see the thing prior to this, the Dustin Rhodes bit?
I had noted that. Did I skip over that? Where was the...
Dustin Rhodes.
Yeah, sorry, that was right after that segment. They come back, and we have a Dustin Rhodes video warning us about the upcoming explicit segment. It's probably a few segments too late. And gratuitous violence. He pushes people to go watch a special on reptiles over on Discovery. And then we had a thing at the end. Paid for by evangelists against television, movies, and entertainment in general.
So what incarnation of Dustin Rhodes was this?
This was the born-again Dustin Rhodes that was going to be playing kind of a precursor to the Right to Censor.
Mm-hmm.
And would eventually morph basically back into the Goldust character after... his wife, Terry Runnels, would leave him for Val Venus in storyline. John Wayne Bobbitt wheels out Val Venus along with the Academy Award nominee Yamaguchi-san's wife for a joint press conference, which was the ha-ha name of this segment that they pushed all show long, hosted by none other than Jerry the King Lawler. Now listen, I think we all know what this segment was going to provide, and Jerry Lawler, say what you will about this man, this is certainly in his wheelhouse to make dick jokes for a segment designed for dick jokes. And Lawler really fumbled the balls. Because that was funnier than anything Lawler said. These were the lamest fucking jokes that he had a goddamn week to read out of his joke book.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen! Mr. Bobbitt, I understand that you and Bob have become quite the buddies. Been going all over town, right? What about last night?
Oh, we had a great time. We live on the edge, you know. We went out for a couple beers, and Val ordered a club soda with a slice, and the bartender wanted to cut us off.
Listen, I want to know one thing real quick. Not trying to cut you short or anything, but now come on.
Oh, this was a very interesting segment.
No, I was a little disappointed.
Venus is icing his balls, and he has asked, "Are you still hanging in there?" Then a fan, who is probably still on cloud nine after yelling "Stay Together" with DX having a reunion, yells out, I assume to John Wayne Bobbitt, "Get a real dick!" And then
what happened to? Didn't he? He does have his real dick, doesn't he?
John Wayne Bobbitt had his. I didn't do my background research on John Wayne Bobbitt. Did they not surgically repair?
Yeah.
The,
I assume they just picked it up from the lawn and had it sewed back on.
Well, I almost went to look this up.
Don't bother.
I don't think I will.
Let somebody in the fact-checking thread do it.
That's right. Leave that to them. Venus says the women better put a rain check on those snake skin boots because the big Valboski lives. What an ego to think that his severed penis would be used for boots. I don't think that's...
What?
Well, he said, put a rain check on those snake skin boots. Like, was he trying to mean, like, if what? His penis had been cut off, there would be suddenly a creation of snake skin boots out of the excess skin?
Well, they wouldn't be snake skin. They'd be... They...
What was he trying to tell it? Like, his anaconda, I think, was the reference here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if I'd want to wear boots made out of dick skin.
Many layers to these Val Venus promos.
Before skin boots.
He explained that thanks to some last-minute shrinkage during the near chopping, and John Wayne Bobbitt just showing up and cutting the lights off at the right time, Val Venus remains still at attention and cocked, locked, and ready to unload.
So John Wayne Bobbitt just happened to be...
He just happened
around.
To be backstage. He was one of those photographers that was watching on. Lawler then awkwardly tells this joke about John Bobbitt going to a bar and the bartender cut them off. That was the punchline. Then Lawler says he doesn't want to cut them off. Just horrible one-liners after horrible one-liners.
Terrible timing. The same joke.
Yeah. Venus gets the last word. He tells Yamaguchi-san's wife that it ends now and no woman is worth this trouble. And then, if you're a female and have not hit the bottom level of just respect for your gender, they hit a new low here. Passing a battery to Yamaguchi-san's wife to take care of her needs in the post-Val Venus world for Yamaguchi-san's wife.
This is the baby face.
Yeah. What a wonderful baby face, and what a positioning for women. On this show.
This is very offensive.
Really offensive. Yeah. Like, I don't know. That was our involvement of John Wayne Bobbitt. What an investment.
Yeah.
So, Canadians, there you go. After all these years, you finally know.
This is definitely the type of clip I think our socialism teacher would have showed us in class.
Yeah. We could have...
Sorry, not socialism. What class?
Sociology.
Sociology.
Yes, with Professor Golden.
That's right, Gene Golden.
They keep pushing tonight's main event as the most star-studded and controversial main event ever. Edge is spotted in the crowd. Another brawl for all. This one at least had some fun moments. Mark Marrow and Bradshaw. Where, you know, Mark Marrow, they'd always pushed as this Golden Gloves boxer, but that really meant nothing in this match against Bradshaw, who was largely just a... tough Texan.
And just a bigger guy.
A much bigger guy. This size discrepancy was nuts.
Bigger guy who was able to take down, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this was not a stylistic masterpiece.
Mero lost the first round match, too.
Yes, and he was back in. Bradshaw had beat Mark Canterbury in the sloppy brawl 2 months ago, they said. God, did this tournament drag. Though these were real fights, and these guys probably shouldn't have been fighting in this proximity. And then they show the brackets. So this is a first-round match. I was completely confused. The winner takes on draws. Mero is back because Steve Blackman had gotten hurt. So Bradshaw gets the takedown. Mero lands a left. Round ends with a 5-5 tie because Mero outlanded him but suffered the takedown. Second round continued. Very uneventful. Crowd hated it. It's 10-10 after two rounds. Bradshaw then throws him down, and Mero gets pissed that Bradshaw won't let him go, to which Mero yells, "Give me a fucking break!"
It's because Bradshaw, they were clinched up on the ropes, and Bradshaw wouldn't let go. So, but off of the clinch, Bradshaw would get his takedown. And Merrill's like, and Jack Doan initially is like, "Okay, you got your five." And then that's when Mero got really upset and called bullshit on it.
Mero connects against the ropes. They both fall. Might have been a takedown. Lots of boos here. They announce it as a draw, so we're going to get an extra goddamn round. 15-15 tie. They booed the announcement of the extra time. Like, in a pro wrestling match, it's like the ultimate babyface pop. You go the time limit, you're going to give 5 more minutes. Complete opposite here. Bradshaw won this with a takedown. Just a shitty fight, and Bradshaw's declared the winner.
Yeah, just terrible, really bad technique from Bradshaw. I mean, if Merrill had any technique, you really couldn't see it here because it was any of his technique was just rendered quite ineffective when you allow takedowns to a guy who's much larger than you. And Bradshaw, he just came across like a real dick in this match. Just like clinching and like just not going for takedowns when he was supposed to break, holding the guy. But I love these. These are always, like, so much fun to watch because they're just, like, they're so experimental. They're just fun, goofy experiments with big, you know, sloppy brawlers who have no business, you know, doing real fights. And so I'm always entertained.
More Michael Cole. He's with The Undertaker. And The Undertaker says, "I'll do my explaining in the ring," and walks off. What an interview.
At least he didn't give him a wedgie.
This was a high point for Michael Cole.
Yeah.
They announced just out of nowhere, next week we will have a three-way with Ken Shamrock, Dan Severn, and Owen Hart.
Sure.
Teams come out for the main event. Shamrock attacks Owen Hart and applies the ankle lock. Rest of DX runs in. They're fighting The Rock. The Nation runs out. There's a big brawl. Owen's tapping out. They come back, and D'Lo Brown has come in to replace Owen Hart in a match. I thought for sure they put draws in there. Why not? He's had a quiet night so far. So it's Austin and The Undertaker against The Rock and D'Lo Brown against the New Age Outlaws and Kane and Mankind. A four-way for the tag team titles. The reaction for Austin was gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
Man, was this guy just on fire at this point. This crowd just, like, this was like a non-pro wrestler reaction. Just massive star.
And you can really just even, it's not even anything to do with... Just simply the way he carried himself, the way he was able to walk, and just the swagger he had. It just, like, really, you know, oozed out of him.
The match begins, and just the crowd's just going insane for Austin. He went for a stunner early that Mankind avoided, and then they go up the ramp. Very, very hot crowd. Ross is listing off all the champions in this match. You have the WWF champion, the IC champion, the tag champions, and now the European champion in D'Lo Brown. Gunn comes in. He had a famouser to D'Lo. There were chants of Rocky sucks. They got through a bunch of tags before Austin was tagged back in, and just massive reaction as he then tags The Undertaker, who were clearly the two pivotal figures everyone was most interested in. As big as Austin was, crowd took to The Undertaker really big as well in this match. Rock and D'Lo are working on Road Dogg together, crowd constantly chanting for Austin. We saw a Sky High by D'Lo delivered to Road Dogg, and then the People's Elbow, which the people were cheering already in 98. Austin breaks up the cover. All the crowd wanted was Austin in the match, and they just milked it until he would be back in. Taker gets tagged in. Austin then comes in. Everyone's fighting. They're all going around the ring. There's a chokeslam delivered to D'Lo. And then out of nowhere, Kane chokeslams The Undertaker as Austin is on the floor. And Kane pins The Undertaker to end the match. And thus, Kane and Mankind win back the tag titles. And Taker just pops up quickly. And they ask the question, did Kane get the win because The Undertaker let him as a way to fuck with Austin? So Austin is upset, looking at The Undertaker and asking him what happened. And the show goes off the air with Ross promising an update this weekend on Sunday Night Heat, a really big push for that Sunday Night Heat show. And then we got bonus material on the network with Austin getting into the ring with Undertaker. They share some words. Taker points at the title around his waist, and then Taker leaves, and they go off with Austin's music playing to end our second episode of Raw is War.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the second episode a little bit more, but who cares? It's not even worth talking about which one's better. These are just all shows that kind of, you know, exist on their own. You know, good show. Very hot crowd, very hot characters again. I thought they built the main event up pretty well. I thought JR really was at the top of his game calling this style of pro wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a really hot time for the company. You were building to a really big show with a main event people wanted to see in Austin and The Undertaker. So, I mean, it's hard to criticize because it certainly was a formula that was working in the summer of 98. And that's the ultimate test, did it work for the time period? And it did.
Did you enjoy going back to watch these shows in 2015?
Overall, I did. I found them pretty easy shows to watch. I mean, very much ADD programming of these Raw episodes.
Yeah. I wouldn't go back to watch any of these matches, but like some of these angles, and even, you know what? The Brawl for Alls were fun to watch. I'd almost say those were the highlights in terms of in-ring.
Yeah. I mean, I like going back and watching some of this. They were easy shows to watch. I'll say that. I watched them in about two sittings. But we are going to go to the feedback. We have gone super long. Originally, we were going to try and get a guest for this show, but that would make this show over 2.5 hours. So,
yeah, we hit the cottage.
I never know if people want to hear guests on the show or just hear us yap for whatever.
Depends on the guest.
Well, let's hear from Brad from Whitby, who says, because the Balvenus angle was so heavily influenced by how Japanese culture traditionally deals with adultery, I've decided to embrace another traditional custom the Japanese gave to us to express my thoughts. So my feedback will come in the form of a haiku for each episode. For August the 3rd, Val betrays partner, taken away to be chopped, the show cuts to black. And for August 10th, John Wayne Bobbitt saves, cold block provides much shrinkage, Val's penis lives on.
All right. Thank you. We got Andrew McDonald who says, I thought the shows were excellent, and WWE nowadays could learn a thing or two about their shows during the Attitude Era. I thought the shows flowed well. The matches were okay. The main storylines were consistent and based around the tag titles and eventually the world title and the big Austin Taker match. But you can't have an Attitude Era show without some Attitude Era staples. First, when I watched the show, I felt, wow, this is great stuff, just like I remembered when I was 12. And then they showed drugged up Road Warrior Hawk, and then I realized what I got myself into. The big negatives of the show were bad. The Attitude Era staples like this, unnecessary chair shots to the head, mooning the audience for the amusement of 12-year-olds like myself at the time, the Brawl for All and its needless injuries, and of course, Val No Penis Venus. What was funny was after they started carrying Val to the back, they switched to a toy commercial for children.
No, why not? Okay, next up, we have Christian. I watch these shows on Daily Motion, and I would advise others too, as well, as they include some horrendous advertising, including Triple H's selling... No, those Stridex and Stomp 2, they have been preserved on the network. First off, this is my all-time favorite Raw opening. The song and the video are still amazing, but that could also be nostalgia on my part. This is when I first got into wrestling. I remember the Venus angle so well from watching at the time, and it's still as stupid now as it was then. It was shocking TV for no result whatsoever, unless you really like listening to a man talk about his dick. I did forget about the Dustin Runnels angle that would lead to him working Val and then bringing back Goldust. I am looking forward to your thoughts on this angle, as it's one that you've mentioned often on previous shows. I never want to hear the word jack off again. Boy, did DX overkill that in a 2-minute span, all for China to show her ass off. DX really doesn't stand the test of time for me. These shows had one of my all-time most hated, overused storylines in wrestling, which is the champion and challenger also being the tag champions. It's been done so many times. What I did love is that Austin saying he didn't care for the tag titles at all, barely even holding it over these shows, and yet he was really annoyed when they lost them. The whole Taker, Kane, Austin, McMahon story was just a little too long and had too many twists for my liking.
Hands of Trash. Bet you guys weren't thinking about having to relive the Brawl for All tournament when you picked these shows to review, did you? It was interesting to see how out of date the intro for the show at this time was. You could still see Brett, Psycho Sid, and Ahmed Johnson fighting in that ring. I guess that's why WWE intros these days exclusively use highlights.
Dwayne in Ireland, my God, was Mick Foley in the midst of taking some ridiculous punishment during this time period? Countless unprotected chair shots, a clip of a nasty table spot on Heat, and none of it meant anything in the long run. Pretty sad to watch, especially off the back of the King of the Ring bumps just 2 months earlier. What the hell happened to Vader around this time? Dancing and jiving during his entrance? It was like when you change a wrestler's entrance in a wrestling game, something completely unbelievable happens. Vader just simply didn't fit in the Attitude Era. At least we know where Roman Reigns got the inspiration for his cock this fist and make it rain in this bitch line after the Valve Venus cocked, rocked, and ready to unload promo on the second Raw. 5 jack-offs out of 10, the Attitude Era of 98-99 is just way too overrated.
We got a bill from Hamilton. The angle involving Austin and Taker with a lingering suspicion involving the brothers in cahoots angle had my 15-year-old self on the edge of my seat every week thinking, is this the week Taker reveals his alliance with Kane, or is it all just a ploy by Vince to screw with both of them? When I think back on this time nowadays, I don't think about PPs getting choppy chopped. I think of guys like Taker and Austin, the continuing rise of Rock and Triple H, underrated feuds like Owen versus Shamrock, but I'd be lying if I said I didn't have a fondness for the oddities.
And the last one before we wrap this up, Brandon from Charleston. I'm currently through February of 98 in my rewatch of the Attitude Era, but jumped ahead to watch these two episodes. It's incredible how quickly storylines progressed in those few months. I actually think this style of booking is geared more towards today's ADD society and would be much more successful than today's show. With the ratings being the lowest since 97, do you think we will see Raw blow up the current format and maybe go back to this style? Not so much the vulgar, but the importance of keeping things moving with more call-ups, stables, and less 15-20-minute monologues to start the show. I don't see the Raw formula changing all that much. I think they're very much set in their way, and even their numbers now, they're very strong. And one of the issues when you have the success at a level of WWE is it makes it a much more rigid formula in terms of doing drastically different things. TNA has the luxury of the level that they're at that they can go in radically different directions without compromising their current level and maintaining that. Whereas the WWE, it's very hard to go from a company that generates all that they do and have that fan base to do something radically different with the risk involved of not being able to maintain what they have already built. And I think you've seen that as a result over the past 15 years of where Raw has evolved to. They have a very set formula of how they shoot a show, how they present characters, and they're very much tied to that format as we see it now. So that is all the feedback. Thank you all for sending in your thoughts on these two episodes of Raw from 98, which you can go back and watch on the network if you so choose. Next week on the show, we are going to go back to another gem of WWF programming, that being the Tuesday Night Titans series, which this was from the request thread. And I'm just going to read the description of this. October 29th, 1984. Brutus Beefcake performing at a strip club. Johnny Valiant love advice. Sergeant Slaughter in-depth interview. JYD soul food tasting. How this can possibly disappoint, I cannot come up with any way possible.
Mm. I can't wait.
I cannot wait for all of this the Tuesday Night Titans episode.
This is on the network?
This is on the network. So you can go look that up. October the 29th, 1984. We already reviewed a Tuesday Night Titans earlier this year, which Again, another gold mine for review possibilities, and I think the description here certainly lending itself well for our reviewing tastes. So that's going to be up next week on Review Away. Very, very busy week and weekend in professional wrestling. We've got all our normal shows up at liveaudiowrestling.com, iTunes, all that great stuff. You can catch our TV version of Review a Raw. It's up at youtube.com/fightnetwork, and it airs Tuesdays on the channel at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern Time each Tuesday. Prime time.
Prime time.
That's it.
Tuesday night, Titans.
Yeah, exactly. We're the new Tuesday night Titans. Mm-hmm. And then this weekend, Ring of Honor is going to be in town for two big shows at the Ted Reeve Arena with talent from New Japan Pro Wrestling. I know you are going to be going. I will be there, so hopefully we get to meet up with some listeners and see them. Anyone in particular you're looking forward to seeing live? Tanahashi's going to be there.
Yeah, I think Nakamura. A lot of the New Japan guys, definitely. You know, for sure.
All right. I wonder if you'll get any autograph requests.
If people think I'm Okada or something.
We'll find out. Will you go with it if they ask you?
Yeah, I'll definitely sign as Okada.
We should fuck with people and have, like, Braden, like, take a selfie with you, and people just look and assume you're somebody that's on the roster.
Yeah.
And then they'll probably just deduce, I mean, who's masked and who's not. Maybe even not. Maybe they'll come up and think you are Okada.
Yeah, yeah.
Should dye your hair blonde.
That actually has happened.
Where you were thought to be Okada.
At the UWA. UWA.
That's
back
right.
Back when Okada actually wrestled there.
And what happened when this person came up to you? Did you go with it?
Somebody thought I was one of the wrestlers, and I was like one of the few Asian guys at the place. And, I mean, Okada and Liger happened to be the other two Asians basically in the place. And so this little kid thought I was one of the Asian wrestlers.
And you should have just been, yes, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's me.
Do you want my 8x10? It's $10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's going to wrap up the show, folks. Thank you for listening, and we will chat with you all later this week.
Triple H Hunter Hearst Helmsley knows how to take care of business. Stridex Triple Action Pads know how to take care of your skin. And now there's two great offers from Stridex. Save 70 cents on specially marked boxes of maximum strength, regular, and sensitive skin pad. Plus, get this free Triple H poster with the purchase of any Stridex pad product. Just mail your name and address, a Stridex box top, and receipt to the address shown. Supplies are limited, so act now. Triple clean your skin with Stridex medicated pads.
So you can deal with tougher things.